From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, as the state budget is being negotiated, the Wisconsin Policy Forum looks at the financial outlook for MPS, the state's largest school district. Then the On the Wing program gives sketchbooks to at-risk Milwaukeeans, and now some of these pieces are featured in an art exhibition.
Combining the House of Peace sketchbooks with the local artist community sketchbooks completely dismantled any notion of who's better or what's worth more money.
How simple and familiar changes can help prevent Alzheimer's and other dementias.
You need to exercise 4 times a week, 30 minutes at 150 plus heartbeats a minute. You need to keep your weight under control. You need to be on a BMI, body mass index, under 29.
And sports contributor Sean Rampt returns to his first love, poetry. Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. The school year is drawing to a close, but Milwaukee Public Schools is in the middle of figuring out its 2019-2020 budget. Superintendent Keith Posley has proposed a plan that protects classrooms from cuts, and it adds about 100 new positions and provides a 2.44% salary increase for staff. Wisconsin Policy Forum researchers Ann Chapman and Rob Hankin say the budget accomplishes this with one-time fiscal maneuvers, cuts to the central office, and drawing down monies from construction funds. But in a budget brief released last week, the researchers point out that MPS's financial future is likely to change. Republican lawmakers are pushing for a $500 million K-12 spending increase. That's much less than Governor Evers wants, but nonetheless it would mean more money for NPS. WUWM's Emily Files spoke with Hankin and Chapman about the financial outlook for Wisconsin's largest school district.
This was a very difficult budget to size up because on the one hand, you do see what seems like an easing of the fiscal pressures, the fact that these 108 positions were able to be created, the fact that an inflationary salary increase, school budgets were kept whole and even increased a little bit, and even the central service reductions, which has really been a key component of the new superintendent's plan, those were kept relatively to a minimum. On the other hand, however, you look at that, you juxtapose that with the count with the MPS's long-term fiscal outlook, and you see that if revenues stay flat, these fiscal pressures are going to continue to grow. And I think one thing that often gets obscured is, so we can say that there are some increases in this budget and things don't look as bad, but when you really think about the types of fundamental investments that a district with the challenges like MPS would ideally want to be making in its teacher workforce and in all sorts of instructional areas, that often gets lost as they go from budget to budget, just sort of trying to get by.
So Keith Posley has been at the helm of MPS for about a year now. When he took over as interim superintendent, he completely changed his predecessor, Darian Driver's budget. So how would you describe Keith Posley's overall budget strategy?
His main goal with this budget was to keep the schools whole. So the main departure that was implemented last budget, which was initially proposed by Dr. Driver, was sort of trying to balance needed cuts between the schools and the central services. And they were trying to make that sort of heavier on central services than the schools, but there were some cuts. When Dr. Posley came in, he found money through various means, cutting central services, and found some new federal money to put all the money back in the schools. And so they didn't make a cut last year, and that was his goal again this year. So that was the main thing. And then they followed through with that. There were a number of sort of one-time fiscal maneuvers that they found that they were able to do this year that likely will not be something they could lean on next year. But all told, they were able to keep the schools whole.
So can you talk more about these one-time fiscal maneuvers and the fact that Superintendent Posley, in order to protect classrooms, is drawing heavily from the construction fund and central office, cutting positions in central office? Can you talk more about those decisions and the implications?
So the construction fund is just sort of it's exemplary of what we see in governments and school districts that are facing severe fiscal pressure. One of the first things that often goes in a government that is in severe fiscal distress is that they put off taking care of their infrastructure. We also see that there was a one-time maneuver, a separate chunk of surplus from the construction fund, $4.3 million, was actually put into school operations, but that's for minor maintenance. But these are the types of things that you don't want to see repeat themselves year after year.
Yeah, and in terms of the cuts that they've made to central services, several of their central offices, they made some cuts. Other offices, they made increases. So the main area where it looks like the cuts probably happened is in the area of academics. So it's hard to discern the impact that might have. And like we said, they have to find ways of finding savings. So there isn't a criticism here, but the what we say in the analysis is, to the extent that they're making cuts in offices, for example, that are charged with things like educator effectiveness, professional development, new teacher induction and support. We just say that this should be something that is looked at on an ongoing basis in terms of what is the impact for how the district can serve its needs and its teachers and its students.
And I would just add that so we do similar analyses of the City of Milwaukee budget and Milwaukee County budget every year. And this is, again, not unique to MPS. In this sort of desperate attempt to stave off service cuts, oftentimes the first thing that goes are administrative positions. And again, as a general rule, it's hard to argue with that approach. But we look at Milwaukee County, for example, where there are no longer deputy directors in many large departments and where research analysts and budget analysts have been trimmed. And it starts to really impact the ability of the government to sort of dig its way out of its problems because they don't have the staff capacity to do the types of research and analysis and so forth.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about the reaction that this MPS budget has been getting at public hearings. I'm going to play some audio from the most recent public hearing on the MPS budget.
We cannot attract and retain qualified teachers.
And from the day I walked in the door, I have been consistently and constantly disrespected by this administration in more ways than one, but most of all, in what we're being paid.
It's time our educational assistants get a salary schedule that compensates them.
I'm looking into donating plasma this summer to make ends meet.
So even though this budget spares classrooms, cuts, and even adds some teaching positions, the reaction from the current MPS employees has been pretty skeptical or even negative, saying that there needs to be a more appealing work environment to retain the current staff and even fill the positions that exist. So what do you think about the employee reaction to the budget?
It speaks to the sort of the rock and the hard place that the district is in. At first, the reaction last year to the budget when Dr. Driver unveiled it, when there were pretty significant cuts to schools, the tone felt very similar to the reaction this year, where there was an effort to keep things status quo. And so status quo seems like, compared to last year, seems like an improvement. But status quo is not where the district wants to be. Status quo is not where the teachers want to be. Status quo is not where the district needs to be to attract and retain teachers, which it really needs to do, because turnover at MPS is relatively high and turnover is not good for student outcomes.
Part of the issue, of course, is Madison, and there's just a finite amount of resources. So to do the things that are that some of those who are testifying suggest need to be done, there either needs to be increased revenue, which now we may see some of that increased revenue, or there has to be another look at where else could dollars be cut from the existing MPS budget without sacrificing teacher workforce issues, et cetera. And we do point out in this report that there are two areas in particular. One is transportation, the other is facilities, that have been looked at before and that clearly are going to have to be on the table. Now, of course, with both, there are impacts. And so these aren't easy things to do. If they were easy, they would have been done already. But really, our take is that there needs to be some concerted effort on both sides of the equation, both the expenditure side and the revenue side, if we are to try to make a dent on these teacher compensation issues, which clearly are a real issue for the district.
MPS is the biggest district in the state, and it serves a high concentration of low-income students of color, students who are coming into school with a lot of needs and with a lot of disadvantages. So how does MPS's financial situation affect the district's ability to give these students the education and the support that they need?
Well, so we have not taken a deep dive into issues like the mental health services that are being provided by MPS. But clearly, there are areas from guidance counselors to nurses to behavioral health professionals and so forth, where we certainly hear anecdotally that the demand for those types of services far exceeds the supply in terms of what MPS is able to provide. So clearly, you know, these are the areas. As we focus on the real major areas, can you keep enough teachers in your classrooms to avoid class sizes from growing even more out of control and so forth? Those tend to be the top priorities. Sort of, you know, obscured by all of that is what's going on underneath. And are we providing the types of supports that the economically disadvantaged student population that MPS is trying to serve, that population really needs? And we can't quantify that. We can't say, you know, the extent to which that is being done or not being done. But clearly, it's a challenge, and fiscal instability is not helpful in terms of meeting that challenge.
And to go along with that, just to sort of highlight a nuance there, is that MPS's revenue limit, so the main source of its resources, is right in the middle of all the school districts in the state. It's not especially low or especially high. But the issue is, because it has students that have these additional needs, it has to divert a lot of those resources just to meet those basic needs of the kids. And maybe it's not even mental health sort of crisis resources, but it's guidance counselors to help those kids figure out how to apply to college, because they maybe don't have the resources at home that other kids do. So it, you know, on this, you could look at the dollars and say, oh, they're right in the middle, you know, but they don't have as much access to those dollars for sort of promoting and advancing students as much as meeting basic needs.
Wisconsin Policy Forum researchers Ann Chapman and Rob Hankin spoke with WUWM's education reporter Emily Files. There's a link to the forum's MPS budget brief at WUWM.com. Coming up next, a look at the On the Wing program, which gives at-risk Milwaukeeans sketchbooks, plus an exhibition of their work. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Sketchbooks offer an intimate look at the soul of an artist. An exhibition at the Portrait Society Gallery in Milwaukee's Third Ward is putting those souls on display. The exhibition features sketchbooks from the gallery's On the Wing project, which gives sketchbooks and art supplies to Milwaukeeans at the House of Peace Community Center. The project encourages people to draw in that sketchbook, and for their efforts, they're paid $50 for each completed one. Gallery owner Deborah Bramer created the program a few years ago, and she decided to feature those sketchbooks at her gallery along with some sketchbooks from other artists. She and local artist Pat Hitson, who works with the On the Wing project, joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to tell us more.
Well, I've had the gallery in the Third Ward for 10 years now, and it's one of the city's most prominent contemporary art galleries. And the gallery has always had an emphasis on diversity and showing just a wide range of artists. And after, 8 years of doing this, I realized we needed to take another step and get into a broader neighborhood, cross the great race divide.
I was at an art opening, and Deborah presented her idea to all of us, and she explained how when she was observing the homeless population and aspects of the population that normally a gallery owner wouldn't be able to have access to in terms of how do you engage, she said she wanted us to start to contribute to a fund so that she could distribute sketchbooks to them.
So how did you start to, you know, bridge that divide?
So I've always been interested in the sketchbook. I carry them with me. My purse is full. When I travel, I always keep a sketchbook. I taught art history at the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design for 10 years. And in order to engage art students in art history, I realized if they worked in sketchbooks, they were much more grounded with the visual. So it was a natural extension to think about how can we move into other communities with the idea of doing sketchbooks, which are open-ended. It's not about creating a great work of art or a masterpiece. It's about process. It's about exploring one page after another page after another page and taking risks and playing and seeing where it takes you. So that was very appealing. And we thought, well, let's see about working with homeless populations. So we first went to the St. Ben's Meal Program, where there's 350 meals served every night that are organized by the Capuchins, monks. And that was a little hit or miss. We were like, hey, everybody, do you want to make a sketchbook? We'll pay you $50 for the finished thing. And, you know, walking around the tables, handing out sketchbooks, it was very hard to get them back. We'd come back the next week, but the population was pretty transient, and so it just wasn't working. And then one of the House of Peace brothers said, you should come to the House of Peace and try to do this there, and we'll support you. So they gave us a room, and it's right in the center. Our door is open. Everybody can see the class, and it's just worked out beautifully.
When you walk into the building, it is truly just one of the most my prized moments during my week. Because the community is gathered, the community members are running the place in the most wonderful way. It's such a pleasure to work with them. And there are all our people around the table, all happy and can't wait to get started. And you walk in and you just feel like, oh my gosh, this is just awesome.
You know, you've called the program On the Wing. What is the significance of that name?
Well, we called it On the Wing because it became apparent that when you work in a sketchbook, when you focus and you draw, you actually really do take flight from your daily troubles and your daily stress. It's something we learned in doing the project that is so apparent, and just about everyone who participates in the project has this moment when they realize, this is incredible. I just spent an hour so focused in this other world of exploration and discovery and color and all the rest of my stresses, all the tension, all the struggles, whatever you bring to that table, when you arrive, it's gone. So On the Wing seemed like a pertinent title for the project.
Now, Pat, you're involved with the House of Peace. For those who may not know what it is, what do they do there?
Well, they provide many different services. They work with Marquette, UWM, various schools, and other providers of resources for the community. So it might be help with your insurance, help with eyeglasses, help with health care. There will be people there from the UWM Nursing School, for example. They do programs. They do instructional programs concerning like perhaps wills or other kinds of things that people need that kind of professional support, and that they certainly wouldn't be able to just walk into a lawyer's office and pay that kind of money kind of thing. But I think that that's also a very spiritually based place in the sense that people are honored and given a sense, I think, of safety there. And that everyone who walks in is part of the community.
They also have a food bank and a clothing distribution site.
So a lot of times our people will come in, and they often will have carrying carts, and it's fun to see what they've gotten that day. Sometimes they'll pull out, oh, look what I got, a lamp. And other times it'll be apples or fresh fruit or bread or things like that.
So a lot of what you've mentioned here is support in various different ways. How do the sketchbooks kind of play into that idea of supporting this community?
Well, when I started, I was working at the cathedral for Deb with this project. And in that, at the cathedral, everyone I worked with was actually homeless. And immediately, it was apparent how the sketchbook engaged people in a kind of conversation where they could flow with their thoughts and they didn't feel like they were in a private, safe place and they could tell their story. And the whole time they're drawing. So while they're drawing, they're very relaxed and they're talking about themselves in a just a much more deep way.
One of the things you mentioned earlier in the conversation was that you pay people for their sketchbooks, which I thought was really interesting.
That wasn't a very important component of the project. We're going into the community and drawing once a week for an hour. And, you know, that's asking people for their time. Even if it's a really valuable thing to do, we are asking them to take it seriously, asking people for their time. And then when they finish a sketchbook, the $50 really says, you know, this is of value. You made something really important here. And because this is a community that doesn't tend to have great visibility or power or voice, putting forth that sketchbook as a concrete object that will stay in the world is a monumental act. And we want to make sure that that's understood and honored. And you know what? It's a great way for people to make a little extra money who are prone to, you know, working and doing artwork and becoming a part of this and sticking with it. We've have some participants who have really been coming to the House of Peace over a year or a year and a half every week, that it's become a part of their life and they've become pretty amazing artists. They were probably already amazing artists, but we gave them a place to share what they were doing and a reason to keep doing it.
Well, now you have this exhibit that shows a number of these sketchbooks. You know, when people go to the exhibit, what are they going to see? What's inside of these books?
They are going to see so many images that they could never imagine, a lot of them all put together in ways that they couldn't imagine, a lot of color, a lot of interesting drawings of settings of coming from people's lives, things that they were their favorite things. They'll read poems, they'll read comments, the comments that the people have made about their lives, very honest comments, because there's writing interspersed in the books. And also, artists from the artist community here in Milwaukee were invited to participate. So there are 50 local artists involved in the project who were very happy to get involved and put their heart and souls into their sketchbooks too. And all of these sketchbooks are all interspersed in the show so that there's no differentiation. The way everything is beautifully displayed and very professionally hung, and posters were made of a lot of the different artists' work. And some of the most fun, amazing posters are done from our House of Peace people because they're just delightful.
It isn't easy to interrupt the hierarchy in the art world in Milwaukee. It's a segregated city. It's very divided. No matter how much attention is brought to it, we still have very white audiences. And this project really successfully did that, combining the House of Peace sketchbooks with the local artist community sketchbooks completely dismantled any notion of who's better or what's worth more money. All of the sketchbooks are for sale for $100. So that was like a remarkable part of this project.
And the opening, our fundraising opening, was truly a dream come true because the community was completely all mixed up and everybody was talking to everybody. And it was just completely like all as one.
Deborah Bramer is the owner and director of the Portrait Society Gallery, located in Milwaukee's 3rd Ward. Pat Hitson is a local artist who works with the On the Wing project at the House of Peace. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and there's more information about the exhibit and the project at WUWM.com. Coming up next, our Fit for You segment looks at how simple daily habits can be a powerful tool in preventing Alzheimer's. Lake Effect continues with that in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Those who are voices crying.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. There are approximately 50 million people living with some form of dementia, including Alzheimer's, worldwide. This rate is expected to nearly double by 2030 and triple by the year 2050. The global costs of dementia were estimated to be around $1 trillion in 2018, and those are expected to rise drastically as well. But the UN's World Health Organization recently released the latest risk reduction guidelines for Alzheimer's, and the report confirmed earlier research showing that up to one half of all Alzheimer's diagnoses can be postponed, reduced, and possibly even prevented through simple lifestyle changes. For this month's Fit for You, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Chuck Stetson on the phone from Europe. Stetson is the founder of the Healthcare Impact Foundation, which focuses on treating and preventing Alzheimer's. He begins by explaining why Alzheimer's and dementia have been the focus for his family's work for generations.
Well, this is a coming train wreck. We spend in the U.S. $288 billion a year just on Alzheimer's. That's expected to get to $1 trillion as we have an aging population and as Alzheimer's just becomes worse. And, you know, we have to understand what Alzheimer's and the chronic diseases of cancer, diabetes, obesity, and heart disease are all about. This is a phenomenon of the last 100 years. People aren't talking about it. It did not really occur before 100 years. Why is it occurring now? It's because we don't exercise. We sit at our computers. We don't keep our weight under control. We don't have a good diet. We drink too much. Really, we're only supposed to drink, according to the guidelines at the Cooper Clinic where I go to, no more than 5 or 6 glasses of wine a week. And what happens? Well, there are 20,000 of us that have been going to the Cooper Clinic, and over 20 years, so it's a lot of people, a lot of time, our healthcare costs today are 40% less. And our incidence of Alzheimer's is 38% less. And in an era where healthcare costs are spinning out of control, why aren't we focusing on prevention, which is right in front of us, and we actually have the data? It's up on our website, globalbetterhealth.org, that people can go to. They can hear the stories and the podcasts that we're doing, and they can also then see the actual independent academic research that supports it.
Yeah, and we're going to talk today about Alzheimer's in particular. So how has the rate of recorded Alzheimer's disease changed in recent history? You mentioned it's really on the rise. So what trends have attributed to this from the start of when people first started recording Alzheimer's and when it was really separated from and understood more than just the general dementia umbrella?
Right. Well, Alzheimer's was identified around 1903, 1904 by a doctor named Alzheimer, and he examined a brain of a person that died that had the characteristics that we now know as Alzheimer's, but it was very rare in those days. But what's actually happened is that we have had just very bad health habits. And when people were out in the farm, they exercised, they ate the natural foods from the farm and all that, and they keep their weight under control. And what's happened is that we've had an epidemic of obesity really starting around 1990 or so. And a lot of this is by our technology. We just love our technology. We love our computers. We love all our devices, and we don't exercise as much as we should. And we're just eating very bad food. So what we really need to do is we need to have incentives. One of the things that I'm doing is I'm working with universities. We're putting a university group of universities around the globe. I just was in the Middle East working with a university where we're going to run the healthcare program. And it's a structured program, not an unstructured program where, you know, you think, oh, well, it's good to exercise. No, this is a structured program where we're talking about and monitoring people doing 30 minutes four times a week at 150 plus heartbeats a moment. That's aerobic. Anything under 150 heartbeats is anaerobic and doesn't count. So that we want to know that people are going to be in good health. And we're focused on the next generation because you got to start this thing early. Alzheimer's has now been found in young babies at 11 months old. They're getting amyloid plaque and tau, which contribute to Alzheimer's. And so we got to get on this thing, and we got to get the next generation going on it.
Right. You make a good point that people probably think of this as something to worry about when they're older, and 95% of people with Alzheimer's are age 65 or older. So, yeah, the trouble is, how do you get people to start considering preventative measures early in life, and when is the right time to take precautions? Because maybe they're not thinking about this until, say, an older family member is impacted, not thinking
right.
about
well,
themselves.
Let me take you to Singapore, and we had a meeting of some of the young people there. A professor, a friend of mine at Singapore Management University, had some of her students that had graduated that works with the families, and I asked them, what are the issues that you're facing? What do you care about? And what they care about is they know that their parents and all are going to get Alzheimer's. They don't want it. They don't know anything about it, and they don't want to be solicited. So we can actually help that, and that's what we did with the website that we have, globalbetterhealth.org. We've got stories, so you can listen to the stories. We actually have the World Health Organization's risk reduction guidelines. They're up there, and you can kind of read it. That's what the World Health Organization did is they came in with a bunch of scientists, and they reinforced what the research is already out there. We're just not focused on the research, and we put the research up on our website so that everyone can read it. It's not a solicitation. It's done through our foundation. And what we're now doing is we're bringing governments, businesses, foundations, and family offices together around UN Sustainable Development Goal number 3. And we partnered with the UN. And we've already got a number of governments that are coming together. We're starting to get the businesses together and the foundations. And we're going to focus on a real communication program. And so I'm just delighted to be talking to you because this is where we have to go. We have to have these kinds of conversations a lot more frequently. And it's, you know, it takes 20 years before you identify Alzheimer's, but you can actually have Alzheimer's in those 20 years and not really know it. So we have to get better diagnostics. So this is what we really care about and what we're trying to do.
Recently, the World Health Organization confirmed the research that up to one half of all Alzheimer's conditions can be prevented or reduced, which is, I mean, scientifically, if you look at 50%, that's a staggering medical and scientific number. You know, when it comes to odds, you know, maybe 15% is considered decent, but this is half. So it's
an unbelievable number, but it is, that's what the research says. And the person that did that, a lot of the research and worked with the World Health Organization is Mia Kiva Pelto, who's one of our scientific advisors. She started out with the finger study in Finland, and she's now, as of January, she's working with 15 countries. She's now working with 25 countries around the globe, and she's looking at the prevention of Alzheimer's in those 25 countries. She's looking at men and women, and by the way, women manifest Alzheimer's very different than men, and it's two-thirds of the people with dementia actually are women, and they have special needs, very different from men. We're just beginning to get the tip of the iceberg there. So there's work to be done, but the research that's being done is absolutely phenomenal on prevention because there's a lot could be done now. The old default of, oh, we need more research dollars and we need the government to spend more money on research that, you know, we may find something out in 10 to 20 years. No, we can do it now. It's going to be a process, but I think over the next couple of years, people are going to start to focus on it because we absolutely have to, and that's what we're finding out with the governments, that they're going to have to be partnering with us because we have to get this word out. 75% of the people that came out to vote in the midterm elections came out because of the high cost of health care. You give them a couple of $1,000 off of their health care costs, they're going to be ecstatic.
So with the new guidelines, let's get into the meat of them. What are the new guidelines for preventing Alzheimer's? Like, what tactics are doctors using within the office, and what are some tactics people can do in their own power, at their own home, with their own minds?
Yeah, well, what they're doing is the guidelines are actually kind of a consensus statement of a whole bunch of scientific advisors and medical advisors, and they're reaffirming that physical exercise is really one of the top priorities. It comes up with a strong recommendation. Also, eating well comes up with a very strong recommendation. They have some that, like depression, that's conditional. That means that there are some supporting research out there, but it's conditional because it's not quite as convincing as people would like to have it. So What they did is they went through it bit by bit. But I think the key thing, and what we're doing with universities, is you have to enter and get a structured program. That's what the Cooper Clinic recommends, and that's what I follow. And the key thing is that you need to exercise 4 times a week at 30 minutes at 150 plus heartbeats a minute. You need to keep your weight under control. You need to be on a BMI, body mass index, under 29, preferably it's under 25 if you can get there. But you need to start paying attention to your weight. And the obesity thing just exploded in the 1990s, partly because we have so many devices that we sit and we study our devices all the time, and we don't get up and walk around, and we don't exercise. You know, we do some jogging and cycling and all, but it's not enough to offset all of our bad habits. So we have to really start to take that to heart. The guidelines are helpful, but, you know, if you look on our website, you can actually look at the academic papers and see what the research says. And there's things like there's one paper that we have that I've seen that you have to have a certain amount of vitamin B12, vitamin D, and omega-3 in your blood levels, and that's very helpful to prevent Alzheimer's. You need, instead of 140 over 90 blood pressure, you need to be really at 120 over 90. There's some things. This is what we are working with the universities and implementing in a very structured way, where we're going to measure it, and we're going to reward people appropriately in the university for keeping it on track, and we're going to lower the cost of health care at the universities right now. That's what we can do.
So we have obviously a large population dealing with Alzheimer's and various forms of dementia currently, and it can be hard and expensive to treat, as we've discussed, but it's also hard on family members and caretakers. So do you think if we get more proactive about our brain health now, as we're younger, before these things are diagnosed and happen, that we can create more compassion for the treatment of people with Alzheimer's and dementia currently?
Yeah, well, let me tell you what they're doing. I was just with the chief executive officer of HSBC. It's a big British bank. And what they have become is dementia friendly. They have 35,000 employees on a voluntary basis, 16,000. That's over half of the employees of the bank have signed on to dementia free. What is it? What are some of the policies of the bank? One of the policies is that they do a lot of call center banking activities, and they don't put a time limit. A lot of places today put a 5-minute time limit on call centers. No, elderly people, they misplace their bank cards and it takes them a while to find it. No, it's however long the customer is that they need to do. So dementia friendly is becoming, in some businesses, it's becoming popular. I think it's going to spread. I think that just because HSBC, and they're a very big bank here in Europe, where I am right now, I think it's going to catch to other banks. I think it's going to catch to other businesses, because it has to. And we need to be much more attentive and willing to work with people that are having, cognitive problems. And we have to be a little bit more sympathetic and take our time with them and show them how much we care.
All right. Well, Chuck Stetson, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Great. Thank you so much. All the best to you.
Chuck Stetson is the founder of the Healthcare Impact Foundation, which has a focus on treating and preventing Alzheimer's and other diseases. He joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski for this month's Fit for You segment. You can find a link to the new World Health Organization's guidelines for preventing Alzheimer's at WUWM.com. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Bonnie North. Our next guest is a familiar one. Sean Ramft is our sports contributor. He's also the former editor of the website The Sports Post. But as much as he loves sports, Sean says his true writing passion has always leaned in a more creative direction, specifically towards poetry. Sean joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to share how he came to love creative writing and to read the first of many poems we hope he'll contribute to Lake Effect in the future.
Sean Rampt, welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me back.
So usually in this situation, you are sitting across from Mitch and talking about sports, but today we're going in a bit of a different direction with some reading of poems. So first off, I mean, all of our listeners know you as a sports contributor, but what kind of role has creative writing played in your life?
Slightly different direction today for me. Creative writing, it's what I went to school for, and all through the later years of high school and my entirety of time at UWM, I wrote poetry, mostly. I did a handful of short fiction. I took a lot of electives that had both. And I took two capstone classes that were both in the creative writing field because that's what I wanted to do. Didn't know what I wanted to do with it. Didn't know if I wanted to teach it. But I just wanted to keep writing. And I've always loved sports. And when I got out of college, I was still working a retail job and sort of fell into a sports writing job several years ago. And I really enjoyed it. I got to watch sports and write about it. And for me, that was fun. I was able to add a little bit of creativity back when everything started because we did a lot of editorials. And then things progressed from there. And I took over the site eventually as the editor, and I kept writing. But that also put creative writing on the back burner for a long time because I was still working at my other job. I was working full-time as the editor and writer then suddenly on the sports site. So I did not have a lot of time to do creative writing. I had a lot of old poems written and saved, like hundreds upon hundreds of them, a handful of short stories. But up until 4 months ago, I want to say, I hadn't looked at them for years, for 3 or 4 years, because the sports writing had taken over. And that was not fun for me. Again, that's
to
what
look
I went
back at your old stuff.
It was not fun for two reasons. It was not fun to look back at my old stuff, because a lot of that I wrote when I was in my late teens, early 20s, mid-20s at latest, and some of it was really rough. And I know everyone says that about all of their old work, and I know everyone is probably very critical of their own work, regardless of when they wrote it. But those poems and those pieces of fiction that I wrote several years ago were rough to revisit, necessary to revisit. But then in the last 3 to 4 months, the sports site came to an end, and that was fine. And I didn't know where to go from there for a while, and I had a thought, hey, maybe I should really refocus on what I went to school for and what I really enjoyed doing and what I used to get feedback from. And I used to do readings, and I just started writing little pieces every day now for the last 3 to 4 months when I have time, you know, just a few lines at a time, sometimes several lines that have no relation to one another. And over the last 3 to 4 months, I've written a little over 30 poems now, brand new poems. I don't love them all, but
just for the sake of keeping it and just
consistently getting back to what I really liked doing. And I used to write some short fiction, and I probably will down the line again, but I used to write tons of poetry. That's what I did.
So what is it about poetry, and what kind of form do you prefer or specialize in?
I don't know if I specialize in any of them. I think with poetry, it was just simpler for me. With short fiction, with any sort of fiction, it has to be a certain length. You have to have characters, usually. You have to draw them out. You have to do that. And I'm better at short fiction because I don't have to spend a lot of time on several different characters or even ideas. But with poetry, it can be even smaller scope. I've never written, you know, very lengthy poems, and especially a lot of these new ones. Very short lines, maybe experimental cuts, but not in a weird, it doesn't make sense way. Just kind of, I cut a line where I feel like I should cut a line.
Sure.
You can't do that with fiction. It has to be coherent all the way through. Or with sports. No, you absolutely cannot do that with either of those things. And all through end of high school and all through college, I read a lot of, in terms of style and in terms of tone, more so tone than style, I wrote and read a lot of Edgar Allan Poe poetry and wrote a short story in which I was in it with him because that's what I thought was fun when I was in college. and even wrote parts of it where I was writing my own poetry in the story and having him, a fictionalized version of Edgar Allan Poe, read it and make fun of me for it. So at least I didn't, you know, have myself like, oh, this is great.
Right.
Or something like that. But I wrote a lot of, like, you know, darker, sadder type of stuff. And that's why looking back at some of the old stuff over the last few months from years ago was really cringy.
Full of angst.
Full of angst.
Teenage angst.
And, you know, some angst is fine. Some angst is fine, but it was all angst.
Yeah.
Hopefully that's not what comes through with all these. Some of it.
I guess we'll let the listeners decide.
But yeah,
there.
That's up to everybody else. I'm trying not to be angsty all the time. But yeah, I don't have a specific style. I don't think I do. It seems to be pretty straightforward as I'm reading it and writing it. But again, that's for everyone else to decide, and that's great.
Yeah. Well, let's get into the first sampling, so to speak, of what's to come. Our first poem we have is Scrambled. So can you give us a little introduction as to what prompted this one?
Oh, of course. This is part of the cringy past of mine. There's a couple that I took pieces of from, we're talking 9 or 10 years ago. And it's not all old, but the central theme and the central tone is definitely when I was in my early 20s and had a crush on a girl, as we all do, crush on a significant person in one's life, and it wasn't reciprocated, so I was sad about it, as I'm sure we all get, and I wrote about it, and a lot of it was very bad to look back on. So I kept a couple of things that I really liked, and I added a lot of different little lines in there and try to tie it all together. So it's I guess you could say it's about old love, but it was really never love. It was just old feelings. Old feelings. It was an old poem that I took bits and pieces from.
All right. So, let's have it.
My name is Sean Ranft, and this is Scrambled. Stunning, desperately disengaged. Can you feel the change in the tracks? A step to the right is you and yours. A step to the left is shrouded in simplicity. A step back signals suppressed silhouettes. A step forward to claim your prize. A glance at these cliche crystal eyes. Here rests a girl who is who she is because of who she is, yet she sees what she sees because she cannot see what sits in front of her. Do not love because you do not love. You cannot love if you cannot live in love with the life you leave behind. I'm calling into you. Do not call into true love through empty sidewalks, street sweepers silently serenading the shadows who walk among the living. Here sleeps a girl who cannot tie the lie together with eternal, forever. Never opened eyes try to peer inside the clever lever that is severed. We only wake up when we sleep. The distress of your dress, the seams in my dreams, emotional is you, irrational is me. Love, you know, this is where you need to be. Watching, walking within your hands, can you feel the change in the tracks?
And that was Sean Ranft, our sports and now poetry contributor. Sean, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sean Ranft is our sports and now also a poetry contributor. We have time for a song in today's show. Willie Porter and Greg Koch have been longtime friends of Lake Effect, and they were recently in the performance studio for an interview we will feature later this week. But first, enjoy a Koch and Porter original instrumental, Noodle. Thank you. And that's the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It is 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.